You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As China continues on its path to becoming the world's largest economy, the rest of the world wonders what direction it will take politically, socially, and economically, and whether it will take the lead in global affairs. In his latest book, Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750, Bancroft Prize-winning historian Odd Arne Westad uses history as a lens to gauge China's future actions. It's published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Odd Arne Westad, who is a professor of international history at the London School of Economics, to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Do you think China will become the dominant global superpower?
In economic terms, I think it will, and that will happen reasonably soon. I mean, my guess is that it might even happen sooner than most people expect at the moment, I mean, sometime during the next decade or so. But what we have to watch, I think, is that there is quite a bit of a difference between being the predominant superpower in terms of its economic output to being the dominant superpower in strategic and military terms.
So what does it need to work on in order to take that lead?
It first and foremost needs to find out what it wants to do in the world. This is the biggest problem, I think, for China at the moment, is that it does not know exactly in the direction that it wants to go. I mean, it wants more of what it sees within the current international system. It doesn't want to replace the system as such, but it doesn't really have any ideas or concepts that are Chinese and therefore new to put into it.
You say China has to learn that sticking it in the eye of the world's hyperpower may bring short-term gratification, but it doesn't amount to a grand strategy in international politics.
Yeah.
So that's basically what they've been doing, seeing themselves as both a major trading partner with the United States, but also an adversary in this kind of nasty little game?
Yeah, I mean, that's not uncommon for rising powers to have a need to show that they have a policy on specific issues that is different from the powers that are predominant today. I mean, the United States did that itself during its rise to international stardom as a superpower. It's more the manner in which it's done. It's the lack of cohesion behind it in terms of coming up with a general alternative, if that is what the Chinese need. That's where the problem is.
Is that based on the way the Chinese government is structured? I mean, you have a group of people who come to power, they stay there for a while, and then they're automatically replaced.
Sure.
We're about to see that happen. It seems to me there's probably even less continuity than there is in a country like the United States.
I'm not sure if there's less continuity, but there is less discussion. There is less pluralism. And what we do know, and this is something I think we can say based on historical evidence, is that pluralism in terms of the debate is something that is very much needed as a country is rising in international affairs. I mean, it is a real problem if you think, like the Soviets did, that you have figured out the future and what it's going to bring, and you do not really have a spread in terms of suggestions and ideas of moving forward. And China is not the Soviet Union of the past. But the fact that it is a political dictatorship in terms of decision-making is holding it back in international affairs.
Hasn't China been promoting what it calls its harmonious worldview policy since President Hu Jintao mentioned it during the 2005 Asia-Africa summit in Jakarta?
Yeah. I mean, the question, of course, is what that means. Peaceful rise of China is another concept that is often used with regard to this. I think it has to be much more concrete than this. I mean, China first and foremost today concentrated on its own region. It knows that it doesn't have the capacity to become a global superpower. And I think it wants to become a global superpower at this point.
But it was in the past, and does it have a memory of that, a fond memory of that?
It was in the past the predominant power within its own wider region, and probably at the point when my book starts in the mid-18th century, the most powerful country on earth. But it didn't have a global reach. I mean, no country had a global reach in mid-18th century. But I think today, the focus for China is trying to figure out how they are going to deal with these principles of peaceful rise, or whatever you call them, within their own region. And they're not succeeding very well in doing that at the moment.
Well, your title is Restless Empire, but what I usually think of as empire is the sort of thing we saw in Britain and France, where the empire reached all over the world. The Chinese empire, if we can call it that, is pretty much just contiguous areas.
Yes, it is contiguous. I mean, just like the Russian Empire was contiguous, or the Ottoman Empire, or or the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it's the only one of those that have survived up to today. I mean, it's really striking to see how the present shape of China, its borders, are more or less the same borders as you found during the Qing Dynasty, the last imperial formation in China. There are some exceptions. Parts of Mongolia is gone now, for instance. But basically, during this whole period of what we generally regard as decline and collapse, China has been able to keep to its borders. So in that sense, China is an empire that's trying to behave as if it were a nation state. And this is part of the essential contradiction that I see in China's foreign policy as well.
Because it tries to force people who are quite different, but within those borders, into becoming the equivalent of Han Chinese.
Or at least having an identification of being Chinese as something that is natural and given for them. I mean, the sense that if you read a Chinese textbook, for instance, you get the impression that these people have always been Chinese. It's just that they haven't known it themselves.
You write, the past shapes the present. History is the most fundamental background on which to understand present-day China. Wasn't modern China built on a rejection of the past? For example, during the Cultural Revolution, most of the traditional values were abandoned and even denounced.
This is part of what the book deals with, and it's one of those fields where one has to be very, very careful. I mean, I see China as restless, as able and willing to embrace change, understand change, much better than many other cultures that I know of. So in that sense, there is not just one break, but there are many breaks during the 20th century and during the 21st century. We will see more in the future that are pretty total and immediate. But then on the other hand, of course, as with all countries, there is something that's carried over from the deeper past. I mean, a set of preoccupations with issues, concepts. Concept of justice, for instance, in international affairs, is something that I think the current People's Republic is carrying over from the deeper past, and the sense that China, over the past 150 years, has been treated very unjustly, very unfairly by the rest of the world.
Well, are you talking about things like Confucianism that seem to be such a basic part of the fabric of Chinese thought that it doesn't matter whether you reject it or not?
That's right. I mean, Confucian modes of thinking rather than Confucianism in itself. I mean, Confucianism, the way we've known it through Chinese history, died in the early part of the 20th century. It's never going to reappear. People who rule China today are almost entirely cut off from the classical heritage. I mean, most of them can't read its output because they don't know classical Chinese. But preoccupations in terms of terms and concepts that come out of this Confucianism remain. And justice certainly is one of them. Hierarchy is another. These concerns remain and are put to use in various ways in today's international affairs from a Chinese perspective. But that's not the same thing that as these people are Confucians. They're most obviously not. I mean, they don't study Sun Tzu or Kung Fu Tse himself in order to understand today's international affairs more than we study Plato and Aristotle.
So what is it from the past that is most important in understanding current contemporary China?
I think the concept of justice, of order within international affairs, not necessarily a China-centered order, but an order in which China plays a significant role. A concept such as sovereignty, which I think is crucial for understanding China's international affairs today, comes out of that deeper past. It has to do with respect. It has to do with China being accepted.
The other day we talked about the tension between Japan and China over some islands in the South China Seas. And Japan seems to have more of a real claim on them, but China says its claim goes back thousands of years.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's hard to say in this conflict, and even more so in the conflict with regard to the South China Sea, more important because there are even more resources probably available.
Yeah, everybody wants the oil that's underneath.
Or they think is underneath, or the gas that they think is underneath. Very often Chinese concepts of sovereignty or the extent of Chinese sovereignty is built on an historical argument. But very often that historical argument itself is of a very recent date. I'm not saying that the Chinese are producing this. So there's a kind of assembly line in the foreign ministry that comes up with historical precedent. But they certainly are very good at discovering Chinese explorers and sailors who've gone through these areas in times where most Chinese people who live today have no concept of their history.
My guest is Adnan Westad. His latest book, Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. Well, China has over 5,000 years of history, maybe longer than that. So why just go back 250 years?
That's a hard decision. It's almost like if, 2,000 years, 3,000 years. I think my starting point was that if I really wanted to do a very, very big book, then perhaps I could go back to the beginning of the 20th century. So I was never really considering doing, 2,500 years. But what I did find was that when I started the book, I was pushed deeper into China's immediate past in order to understand the present. I think that is crucial. I mean, the understanding this imperial formation during the Qing era, starting in the 17th century, that modern China comes out of, is really quite essential in order to understand where its foreign policy comes from today.
So how much do we see from the Qing era reflected in today's China? What was the role of international trading during that dynasty?
I think the first thing that we see is the borders that I already, the shape of China, which were created during the Qing, the reach into Central Asia, the reach to Southeast Asia.
Although there were rebellions within those borders, and so the government didn't always control all of that area.
No, not all of it. But they did, in terms of what is today China, during most of the Qing era, the Qing emperors had a reasonable degree of control. But in terms of other issues, that come out of the Qing past, I think, the difficulty with really defining what China is, is it an empire? Is it a nation state? What are the roles of minority groups within China itself? And maybe first and foremost, the very complex relationship to other countries in the region.
And you say that Tsarist Russia was probably the first foreign state that Qing China had something that resembled diplomatic relations with?
Yeah, coming out of the 17th century.
That's because it was a bordering empire.
Right. And because they were two expanding empires expanding into the same region. It's actually very interesting there to see how the two of them started cooperating reasonably early to the detriment of other people who happened to be within this border zone. But there were two imperial
like
programs.
In Mongolia.
Quite. Mongols of various kinds, Tibetans in the north, Kazakhs, Uyghurs. A lot of people that were squeezed to the margins because of this cooperation between imperial Russia expanding eastwards and imperial China expanding northwards and westwards.
But it's part of the problem that China, as you've suggested, although it shares a written language, has so many different dialects and so many different ethnic groups and so many different cultures. Can it ever impose a sense of national unity?
As a state, I think it can. But it depends on a policy that would be radically different from anything that we have seen so far during the People's Republic. It would be accepting difference. It would be giving more power and autonomy to the provinces, not just the minority provinces, but also the big provinces with a Han Chinese ethnic majority that simply are very far from Beijing.
But so you're suggesting more of a federal approach than it now has. They have granted some autonomy to various groups like the Guangxi Zhuang Autonomous Region,
sure,
where they have allowed the Zhuang people to have special privileges. Tibet seems to be an area where they haven't really worked that out.
Well, but even with Guangxi, even with the Zhuang, the reality of their autonomy is really very, very limited. It is the central government that sets the framework for what is going to happen everywhere within China. And I use as an example of that when I teach students on this. All of China is one time zone. Imagine this enormous country, all of it being on Beijing time. That is a clear sign of how centralized China actually is.
And that's a decision made by the Chinese government.
Absolutely.
That would be like California and New York being on the same time zone.
It would. It's even worse. The distance from Xinjiang, far west of China to Beijing, is even greater than across the United States.
My guest, Adnan Westad, is a professor of international history at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He won the Bancroft Prize for a previous book called The Global Cold War. His most recent is Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. It's published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after this. Later on in the show, we'll explore the latest on the New York art season with critics Roberta Smith and Christian Viveros Fawn. And Molly Ringwald will be here in our second hour to talk about adding writing to her acting credits now with her first novel called When It Happens to You. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC receives support from Macmillan, publisher of Monstrous Beauty, a new novel by Elizabeth Fama. To fall in love, a young woman must break a mermaid's curse, but may end up dying in the process. Monstrous Beauty is now available wherever books are sold. The Club at Briarcliff Manor, a new retirement community under development in Westchester, offering Hudson River views and a variety of home styles and financial options. Info Center and model residences open daily. 914-923-4050. New York Live Arts, presenting Voices of Strength, dance and theater by women from Africa. A mini festival featuring choreographers from Mali, South Africa, Ivory Coast, Mozambique, and Morocco. September 18th through 19th, 21st through 22nd. Tickets at newyorklivearts.com.
Every day, another piece of information comes across that you should know. And WNYC gets it out to you. We take the issues apart. We get down to the truth. We invite you to participate. So we're breaking it down, separating fact from fiction. This is your election. Claim it. WNYC Election Coverage 2012. Never turn it off.
We are back with Odd Arne Westad, who has written a book called Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. It's published by Basic Books. A Scandinavian who spends his time working in England?
Indeed, and who first came to China when I was 19 as an exchange student studying Chinese.
And that was a very different China.
Very different China. I mean, it's a remarkably different China.
Mao still in power?
No, it was just after the Cultural Revolution ended, but most of it was still in place. The concept of political education, for instance, as I remember getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning at my university shouting political slogans.
Oh, you did as well? You
got Absolutely. Everyone had to do that. I mean, Chinese or foreigners didn't really matter. But interestingly enough, the place where we used to do that at Peking University have now been transformed into very nice tennis courts.
Well, it's interesting that that time China was largely resistant to the influence of the outside world. But you write that China's worldview has been determined by both its receptiveness and its resistance to outside influence.
Yeah, I think that period during the Cultural Revolution was really an exception. I think China overall has been a very open state, a very open empire.
Even though people usually think of China as being closed off, at least Westerners. Yeah.
I think that's part of the central argument in this book, is that that's a faulty way of looking at China. Of course, there have been periods when China has been less involved with the outside world than others. But overall, and if you compare it to what's happening elsewhere on a global scale, China is very changeable, very often influenced by what is coming in from abroad.
To some degree, weren't they really defending themselves? Because after the Qing dynasty, you had the foreign concessions. You had China being broken up into little bits and pieces. You had Chinese people being addicted to opium as part of the policy of the British Empire. I would imagine that if I were Chinese, I'd say, I don't need those people. I mean, the French, for example, had a concession that was totally lavish in Shanghai, and Chinese people weren't allowed into it most of the time.
Well, I think that's the latter is part of the story now. The Chinese Communist Party was actually founded as a secret organization within the French concession in Shanghai, because the French concession gave them better protection than what the Chinese parts of the city did even at that point. Show some of the contradictions that are here. Listen, I have a rather different view in terms of how this worked in China. I mean, obviously, the Chinese state was attacked from the outside. Many Chinese felt that they were humiliated by the foreign presence. And foreigners did some terrible things in China. On the other hand, the collapse of the empire wasn't just negative. I mean, it opened up enormous opportunities for Chinese to travel, to engage in business, to do things within China that they hadn't been allowed to do before, and for new kinds of education and knowledge.
Did that come when Sun Yat-sen and the Nationalist Party took over? That was a transitionary period, although I'm sure that they didn't think of it as such until Mao defeated the Chiang Kai-shek. What role did that period play in China's sense of self?
I think these changes really start in the late 18th century. I mean, as Qianlong, one of the greatest emperors that Qing ever had, is dying. And there is a general sense of malaise, of things not going very well. And this is something that lasts from that period all the way up to the early 20th century. It sort of bridges the period of immediate collapse of the Qing state. But I think during that time is also when China is at its most open, where it embraces foreign science, for instance, which had been relatively unknown in China, where there are enormous social changes. Think of the role of women, for instance. Think of changes in terms of how the family works, all of which, in my view, are hybrids. I mean, coming out both of the Chinese past and of influences coming in from abroad.
So fewer women are having their feet bound, for example.
Sure.
In 1929, China had its first World Exposition. What was that like?
It was in Hangzhou, in central China, and I think the idea was to try to show what this new China, this Republican China, post-empire, was capable of. It wasn't so much just looking at foreign products being brought in by other countries, although there was a fair amount of that as well. It was also showing what Chinese now were capable of. And when you think about the industrial products, for instance, produced in China that were there, visible to everyone in the late 1920s, you're really struck with the modern transformation of China starting somewhat earlier than what we often think about it as doing.
But China also had to deal with invasions from European countries. The United States was involved. And then, of course, the Japanese invaded Manchuria in 1938.
Mm. Well, I think the conflict with Japan, and this is something I stress in the book, is a distinguishing feature of the creation of modern China. I mean, a set of deep traumas in China that come out of the Japanese invasion and occupation. The sense of displacement, the sense of being marginal to what China earlier had been central to, because what had been regarded as a small and weak state, Japan, on the outskirts of the East Asian international system, now invades and try to take over China. That's a crucial moment for understanding China's foreign affairs, and the echoes of that, as we know, go up to today.
My guess is Odd, O-D-D, Arne, A-R-N-E, Westad, W-E-S-T-A-D. His book, Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. It's published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's a phrase that Chinese people still use when they speak about the world's perception of them, the sick man of East Asia. Where did that come from?
I think the concept was really created in the late 19th century. I mean, the idea that the Qing state wouldn't last much longer. In fact, the Qing actually outlived quite a number of other empires that were in trouble at the time as one cohesive unit. I think overall there was this sense that things were not going well, particularly for the Chinese state. And we tend to be very focused on states when we talk about international affairs. We don't focus on people who move, immigrants and emigrants, on the diaspora. The Chinese diaspora was really created during this period because people were able to move. So, yeah, sickly it was in terms of how the state worked, but in terms of the energy and the capability and the adventurousness of the Chinese people, I mean, this is where that really comes to the fore as well.
Although when the Chinese moved, there were certain rules which led to that whole business about the pigtail.
Yes. I mean, the Qing Empire, at least up to the late 18th, beginning 19th century, they're very careful in having people move out. I mean, it's an imperial way of thinking. You find it in other empires in Europe as well. You don't want to lose people. People is part of your capital. You want to keep them in. But the Chinese have always been able to break away from that. I mean, moving to other places, even under the kinds of restrictions that existed. And, of course, the main restrictions that they came up against were the restrictions by the Western empires for immigration. and by other Western states that had been set up, such as the United States of America, which restricted the number of Chinese who were able to come in. And this is also seen, I think, even today as a very deep injustice.
Mm-hmm. It's only been fairly recent that the United States has changed those restrictive policies.
Yeah, it only goes back, you know, a generation and a half, really. But, I mean, at the bottom of this is something that we rarely think about, I think, from a Western perspective. Where is the justice, seen from a Chinese point of view, in Europeans taking over the rest of the world, taking over the Americas, taking over Australia, exterminating the local population that was there, making them their own, while China is not part of this and not even allowed into many of these countries for a very long period of time?
Chinese have sometimes argued that they don't have any kind of imperial ambitions because they haven't had a history of going elsewhere, although right now there's a lot of talk about that changing if you look at Chinese policies towards Africa and South America.
Sure.
Are we seeing a change there?
Not in any sense that can
it's
be seen
as imperialism.
It's
only economic imperialism.
I think it is economic. I don't think it's even imperialism in that sense, and I think much of this is going to end very badly. I think China's lack of knowledge about engaging with the outside world in a direct sense, with them being the primary investors. I mean, they're happy to invest into the system as such. But for the Chinese, for instance, to run factories or to run mines in Africa, I mean, we've seen plenty of examples of that not working out well. It's often been bad when Westerners and Europeans have been doing it. But it seems to be even worse when the Chinese are moving in to do it, simply because there is not enough respect for what's going on locally.
Do you think that the phrase, the sick man of East Asia, is one of the reasons China put such effort into the 2008 Olympics, kind of a way of putting that notion to rest?
Yeah, I think it was very important in 2008 to show China as a modern, high-tech, powerful country, as a unified state. It's also important to reflect during that period for the Chinese to be brought to reflect on this being something that had happened because of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese Communist Party's rule. So it was a window that had been created into that period in Chinese history.
But communism is a Western concept, and it was imported in China's case from Soviet Russia. So was that seen as some kind of concession, or from the start did Mao try to somehow make it more Chinese?
As so many central ideas in China's history, it was, at least in part, an import, as you say. I mean, it was imported from the Soviet Union. In my view, more from the Soviet experiment itself than from any kind of Marxism and Leninism that really haven't had all that much currency in China.
It was Stalinist communism.
Yeah, it was Stalin's practice, you know, that they decided to build on. And of course, we may ask ourselves today, why on earth, of all possible modernities, did they choose this one? Well, it goes back to what we've talked about earlier on. Soviet communism did have the promise built into it that it was socially just and modern at the same time. I mean, in the 20s and the 30s when the Chinese picked this up. So you could get both of what you wanted in one package.
But communism in China has become what you call socialism with special Chinese characteristics.
Yeah, and even socialism you have to be very careful with. I mean, today this is a market-driven, market-led system.
People own their own land. They own much of the manufacturing, but not all. It's a very strange mixed economy, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't call it a mixed economy. I mean, the Chinese would, or many Chinese leaders would. The reason why I'm resistant to using that term is that there is a relatively high level of state ownership, but within the companies that are state-owned, I don't know of a single one that does not operate according to market principles. I mean, they are as preoccupied with the bottom line as any private company would be, and they are run with that profit motive in mind.
And this is a far cry from what happened during the Cultural Revolution. Why did Mao call for the Cultural Revolution? And do you think that what we see today, to some degree, is a reaction to it?
I think it is to some extent. I think in order to understand Mao Zedong, I mean, you have to go back to the period when he was born. I mean, it's one of these cases where history really matters. I mean, for someone born in the 1890s, China's position in the world seemed very dubious. I mean, there's been a set of disasters, one after the other. And what Mao wanted to do during the Cultural Revolution was to eradicate that old China. I mean, this is not so much about China's relationship with the world, although it's that too, but it's first and foremost of killing off old China, building something that is entirely new, starting over again, making, you know, the Chinese rich and strong through a collectivist kind of approach. So almost the diametrically opposite from what we're seeing today.
Wasn't Bar Shilao, the former mayor of Chongqing, who was recently removed from his position, and his wife has been convicted of murder, in fact, wasn't he a supporter of the ideas that were promoted during the Cultural Revolution?
Well, Bar Shilao was many things to many people. He sometimes borrowed slogans going back to the Cultural Revolution, or Cultural Revolution music, sort of Cultural Revolution kitsch, as I often call it. Whether this actually influenced his politics in any meaningful way is very uncertain. I mean, my general view of the Bar Shilao affair is, you know, there is a murder investigation at the center of it, which now has been concluded. But even without that, I don't think it's in any way given that Bar Shilao would have become one of China's future leaders, although he had a strong position in his province, of course.
There are reports of a split in the Chinese Communist Party. Do you believe that's the case, especially in the light of the disappearance of Vice President Xi Jinping?
I think there are many splits in the Chinese Communist Party. I think this is a party that is very uncertain coming up to its 18th Congress about where it wants to move and where it wants to move China.
Well, how do you read this? His disappearance has been... people have said that it's because he has a back injury, he had a minor heart attack, there was a murder attempt on him, which resulted in a car crash, but the Chinese government is not talking.
We don't know anything about what has really happened.
He's supposed to be the next president.
He is, and of course this is a PR disaster for China. I mean, even if Xi Jinping should show up again tomorrow with all good and well, you know, this is reflected terribly on how China is handling, or rather mishandling, information.
Well, it also has mishandled human rights issues, and that has led to all sorts of tensions with the United States. Congress often pressures the president or the secretary of state to press China on Tibet and on the imprisonment of people who seem to just be expressing the right of free speech, which is guaranteed in the Chinese constitution. So is that going to continue to cause problems between the United States and China? Or does the United States have to totally ignore these things to maintain good relations with China?
I don't think the United States or any country should ignore these gross violations of human and civil rights within China, as you pointed out, even according to China's own constitution, and it's right to point it out. It is, first and foremost, a problem for the Chinese, though. I mean, it's a problem in terms of how China is governed. I mean, I often say that China's biggest problem today is that it's very badly governed, not just because it's governed by a political dictatorship. I mean, that's bad enough, and the lack of pluralism is bad, but also because it's a dictatorship that doesn't work very well as a dictatorship. The splits in the party that we talked about, the irresolution, the uncertainties about how to act on the international stage, dealing with North Korea, for instance, dealing with the South China Sea. I mean, a lot of things does not seem to go very well for this government. And, you know, in other countries, such as here or such as in Britain, this would have meant that the government would have been replaced. But there is no mechanism for doing that in China. That's China's biggest problem, in my view.
And China has a lot of bad PR when it imprisons its most famous artist, when a dissident has to go to the American embassy and request asylum, and the negotiations have to, all of which would embarrass any government.
Yeah, and I think to some extent, there is a great deal of embarrassment, certainly among the younger cohorts within the Communist Party, with regard to this.
Well, we had Gorbachev going into the take over the Soviet Union because of that kind of dissatisfaction. Yeah. Are we seeing anything similar in China?
I think there are quite a number of people, both inside and outside the Communist Party, who think that this needs to change. And not just change on the surface in terms of managing information better, but change more fundamentally in terms of making China a much more pluralist country than what it is today, a more pluralist state. Not necessarily democracy as we know it in the West, but a opening towards a country where it's possible to reach out to its neighbors because it's more self-confident.
Adnan Westad is a professor of international history at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He is the author or editor of 11 books, including The Global Cold War, which won the Bancroft Prize, and the Harrington Award. And his most recent book is Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. It's published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.